Hello, everyone. This is Raise Your Voice as part of the D-Raise Bay Podcast Network. I'm your host, Brett Rutherford, and joining me on today's episode, it's been a little bit, but a familiar guest on the D-Raise Bay Podcast Network and host of Who's On Worst, it's Darby Robinson.
Hi, Brett. It's good to be back.
Yeah, and I wondered, I had all these ambitions going into this offseason, all this stuff we were going to do, hit with a lockout. How much news were we actually going to have to cover? And while there haven't been, although there have been some interesting minor league deals recently, the Rays haven't made any, but across the league there has been. We got some managerial news today as the Mets and Oakland A's seem to both have found their new managers. And while that doesn't seem like Rays news, Rays bench coach Matt Quatraro was a finalist for both positions. And as of right now, I think those are the last two managerial spots left. He will stay with the Rays organization. So Darby, let's talk about the managers that those teams hired first, and then we'll talk about what it means for the Rays to hold on to Q. When I say Q, I'm not talking about any internet conspiracy group. I'm talking about Matt Quatraro. Let's start with
JFK Jr.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Let's start with the Mets. We'll go to the National League. Buck Showalter is back in baseball after a retire. Well, yeah. Did he retire with the Orioles, or was that like a mutual parting of ways type of thing?
It was, yeah. I guess when managers don't manage, it's like sort of a retirement. It's like in between jobs. And
well, it's like they say that Bobby Bowden retired from Florida State when it was, he got a little bit of help when he retired there to get out, all the way out the door.
So the Mets, I feel like a lot of people were, he was the front runner for a while, I think. I think that was the one that people expected them to go with. Steve Cohen broke the news himself on his Twitter page. The Terminally Online owner is still definitely full steam ahead on his Twitter page, breaking news. But I think it's probably the right choice. I mean, Buck's always seemed like a pretty good guy in baseball. He is, a veteran manager, been around the game for a very long time, but also doesn't seem close-minded to new ideas or analytics and new ways of thinking. So I think that's a good maybe blend of like old school and new school. But yeah, he was sort of, I would say that was the favorite. That's no real surprise there, but it is interesting to see him back. Like he had a very good, successful run the last time he was manager with the Orioles. It did kind of peter out, and it's not like it's gotten better for Baltimore. Yeah, I mean, Baltimore had their own issues kind of towards the end there. And so I think a mutual parting, like you said, it was probably for the best because, rather take that, yes, TV deal money rather than be stuck on. Brandon Hyde doesn't seem like he's having the best time over there.
Well, that's the thing, is like we talk about how much impact like a manager has on a baseball team. I don't care who's managing that Orioles team that only won like 47 games. Like that wasn't going to be a playoff team if you just stuck a new manager in there. Like that was not all on Buck.
Yeah, you get Sparky Anderson back and maybe they get to 52 wins. Like yeah, that's exactly. I don't know if there's much there. So yeah, in terms of the choice, it is interesting that the three finalists were two bench coaches from two of the most analytically forward-thinking progressive teams in the Astros and the Rays, and then a long-time around-the-game veteran manager. So I would be so curious to hear, like, behind the scenes, like, who is pushing? Because those are two different tracks.
Well, there was the one report that said that Buck Showalter is who Steve Cohen wanted, and he made that very clear. He wasn't going to be he's the owner of the team. Did have last say, and it was like basically your boss popping in and say, "You listen, it's up to you, but here's who I would really, really like to have as manager." And then ultimately, he's the one hired. I'm not saying that is a bad hire. I guess we'll have to play and see how it plays out. But I don't know, Steve Cohen. Mets fans got so excited when he came in and bought the team, and it's been a disaster since then, and a lot has gone on that's outside of his control, COVID and all this other stuff, but like there's been a lot that's been in his control that he has not done a great job of running and owning a baseball team.
The GM searches were probably the biggest disaster. Like that's how it started, right? He is at the top, so he is going to be in charge of filling out that front office and hiring who is in charge of running the baseball operations. And he's striking out miserably at that regard. And then also in terms of it, not just on the field, obviously success, but I mean, like, he's not doing, it's clearly there's a bad cultural planning from his perspective of vetting these clients, right? You can't have this many off the field disasters from people who are running. These are like Fortune 500 companies, basically. These are mini, you know, multi-million dollar franchises, and they are being tasked with managing and running these clubs. And so you would hope that you really knew exactly who you are turning the keys over to. And he's done a very bad job of that. So I do think going with somebody like Buck, who at worst, I think is a good manager, right? Like, I don't know if he helps them get to another level, or I don't think he's going to hurt a ton. And we have at least known that he's, you know, been around the game a long time, and the people that know him, his personality, his off the field, on the field stuff, that seems pretty well covered. This will be when, you know, there's breaking news and I, this little audio clip can be there. It's like, oh no. Arrested as shouting, I'm a Hall of Fame baseball person. But Buck seems like a much more safe hire than, say, like a Tony La Russa, for instance, where it's kind of like, this seems like a weird choice that could actively hurt your team. I think it's probably the safer choice. And honestly, if you're the Mets, probably safer is better at this point. I don't know. It's a tricky call, but I think this is probably fine. But it's also got through the Metsian lens of nothing the Mets do is going to end up fine. So we'll see.
Yeah. And we talk about going back to Steve Cohen, like one of the biggest reasons that can criticize the Mets and everything they've done, the GM search, is because how much it leaked. This doesn't happen to other teams. I will give them the benefit of the doubt. It's a New York team, very big market. They're the Mets. People always think there's a story. What's going wrong for the Mets? They're just one of those kind of laughing stock franchises. But a lot, everything got out. We knew who their first, second, third, fourth choices were. For them to just get this hire out of the way, like you say, make the safe hire, because it's not going to make or break their season. At least we don't think. It's the Mets. Who knows? But to get the safe hire out of the way, you know what? I'm fine with it. And the Rays get to keep Matt Quatrero. And Danny kind of hypothesized in one of our previous podcasts this offseason that maybe Quatrero would be a better fit on the West Coast with the Oakland A's, who they've not announced it yet, but seemingly focused on hiring Mark Kotze, who was a former major leaguer, is their third base coach, hiring in-house. And that seems like a very Oakland A's type move to just next man up. Who's going to take the job? It's going to be Mark Kotze. And I don't really have an opinion of him as a major league manager. We've never seen him be a major league manager, but seems like pretty run-of-the-mill stuff for that Oakland franchise that is a beacon of consistency.
Yeah. I mean, he played for Oakland. You know, he's their current third base coach. There is a lot of consistency, like you said there. I think that's a fine choice in terms of not knowing anything about him as his managerial style or skills. It seems like on the surface, a fine choice to give a kind of the opposite of the Mets, give a new manager a chance. So that way they kind of have like several kind of years, kind of rebuilding years to be able to learn on the job. Not too dissimilar to Kevin Cash. Coming over, getting the Rays job when he did. He had a couple of years where, you know, you can work out some of the kinks of being a major league manager, and it overall the expectations aren't really high right off the bat. You're not coming in saying, okay, this is a World Series or bust year. It's more like, all right, we're not necessarily rebuilding, not quite to the level where the Oakland A's are seemingly a tear down and rebuild, but it's sort of like 500 seasons are okay. You know, that's you're kind of seeing some good, you're seeing some bad. And by the time that window is open, you are now an experienced manager. I mean, it didn't take long for Kevin Cash to be the youngest, newest manager to now being the most experienced and longest tenured in the American League, I believe, at this point, now that Bob Melvin is with San Diego. So, yeah, go figure. You go from being the fresh face to, well, he's at the top of the mountain in terms of longevity, and obviously now two-time reigning manager of the year. So
wouldn't Francona still have Cash beat if he returns?
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, Tito would. That's right. Oh, and hopefully he does, because you know, everybody loves Tito, and we want to see more Tito and Cash antics.
Yes, because Cash was on that staff as the bullpen coach when Francona first got to Cleveland. So yeah, Cash is up there though, which is insane to think, because I don't know, in my head he just still seems like such a new, young, and fresh manager. He seems like one of the Brandon Staley's of the world.
I was tweeting that because first of all, I just want to say Brandon Staley is an awesome coach in the NFL. I wish his defense could play a little bit to help him out, but I am loving what he's doing with the Chargers. And yeah, I love pushing the envelope of saying we're playing to win. We're going to do things in a way that I think will help us win, and then standing by that. So
I almost wish, in football, you see it a lot more because it's one game a week. There's a lot more press. Kevin Cash has said things like that in the past, but sometimes I want fiery Cash to come out. And the local Tampa Bay media doesn't really question him on those certain things. Sometimes Topkin can, but I'd love to see like a fiery Cash come out after maybe a decision doesn't go the Rays' way, and see him try to defend that, because I know he's done it. He did it after the World Series, but I'd love to see in similar types of decision making, aggressive decision making. That I think there are a lot of similarities between new age NFL styles and Major League Baseball, how you manage like your pitching staff. So yeah, I'd love to see. I know all the Chargers fans that are listening to this are. We get a lot of Chargers fans listening to Raise Your Voice.
Huge overlap.
Bring it back.
Exactly. So yeah, no. I think. Well, I'm curious to see what Mark Kotze, for instance, what kind of a manager is he? Because literally, I have no idea. He waves his arm to send people, and that's all I know about his managerial skills so far. But he has it. It's a good landing spot. It looks like Oakland is tearing it down to the studs. So we'll have some opportunity to learn on the job for a couple of years before they kind of bounce back, because they're Oakland and they know what they're doing. So. Whether it's in Oakland or in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I am curious how that organization moves forward, because it's, you know, we've heard things. Billy Beane has kind of taken less of a hands-on approach. He's starting to look at other business ventures and European soccer. He's been there, done that with baseball. Hasn't won the big one yet, but it's like, how is this? It's going to be not, I wouldn't call it a rebuild. They're not a bad team yet, but they're going to have to definitely retool in a lot of areas, especially if they go forward trading Matt Chapman or anyone else.
Yeah, Matt Chapman, Matt Olson, and if they move like any of those pitchers like Manaea and Montas. So yeah, we'll see. But best of luck to Mark Kotze, best of luck to Buck over in the Mets with Steve Cohen. So good luck. But yeah, Q stays with the Rays. The Rays kind of now have a pretty, this is one of the they did lose one big coach in Ozzie Timmons, but other than that, a pretty stable offseason for both their front office and their coaching staff so far. I guess managerial or in the front office, there could be some slow changes, but pretty stable from last year, which is rare for a Rays offseason.
I want to touch on the front office stuff in just a second, but you talking about keeping Quatrero, I don't really know what he does. Like he's a major league bench coach. It's not like other sports where he's not an offensive or defensive coordinator. Mm-hmm. He's the bench coach. He takes over when Cash gets fired, which rarely ever happens. Like, I don't even know if he's been not fired, ejected. Please. Don't fire Kevin Cash.
Not too often is he getting ejected, but there's that stability there. If he does,
I think stability.
Just do that one of those games. Yeah.
Yes. Stability is the best way to put it. I don't know what he brings other than they're not bringing in someone new, and what they seem to be doing is working. So keeping Q, that seems like a win in my eyes. But at the same time, I'd love to see him go get a managerial job. We talk about all of these former Rays people going on to have success in other organizations, taking a bigger role. I'd love to see that for Quatrero. Couldn't happen this year, but hopefully, next year is finally the year he does get that job.
he's been in the running. He's been in the running for a bunch of different jobs. So I think clearly people like him. There's been a lot of, you know, there's speaking of leaks from the New York, they said that he was really, really impressed, the Mets. So yeah, it's, there's only so many jobs out there. So it is it's really, really tough, but, seems like he was definitely in that running of at least getting those interviews, and we'll see. We'd love to see more of our Rays influence. The cash coaching tree keeps spreading.
Well, I almost forgot, but there were some more Rays news. They have a new general manager. Peter Bendix was promoted to GM when Eric Neander a few months ago was given the title of president of baseball operations. We had a feeling that this might be coming. We weren't sure if it was going to be Bendix or Rodriguez or, I don't know, maybe somebody else. Bendix was given that promotion, and I think that's more so, and I don't want to discredit anything that Matt Quatraro provides to this Rays team. Keeping those front office guys, keeping that, I'll use this lightly, but keeping that brain trust intact, I think is a lot more important in terms of the direction that the franchise is headed in than anyone on the coaching staff, you know, minus Kevin Cash and Kyle Snyder.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think the Rays have been one of the most picked over organizations in terms of front office each and every year. Everybody wants a piece of this front office, which is, I think, just a testament top to bottom how well they do on the field, how well they perform at their positions. But also, I think in terms of just a culture, right? I mean, I think you've seen things like with the Astros, when the whole Jeffrey Luhnow thing kind of like broke down, the Astros went and picked up James Click and kind of tried to bring in not only the Rays mind, but also that culture going away from the kind of like the really kind of toxic levels that were there before, and trying to make it more of a less of a weird corporate hegemony type of thing. And so the promotion of Neander was great because, one, it basically secured that until Eric wants to leave, he basically has the keys to running all of the baseball ops. You know, he is at the very, very top. There's, you know, he is the Andrew Friedman of the Dodgers. He is the Farhan Zaidi. He is the guy that is, every decision goes through like him. That's the very, very top. He can do the big picture stuff. And then the really big day-to-day stuff, the kind of general managing, the kind of the stuff that Chaim Bloom and Eric Shared now gets to have their own position. So that vacuum kind of helps to give everybody a promotion, more responsibilities, more duties, hopefully more pay as well.
Yeah.
So it, you know, kind of it gives that rung on the ladder, right? And that's sort of the thing, is if you can't rise up in your own organization, you're going to go somewhere else where you can. So opening that spot kind of really helped out. I found the tweet from Topkin to kind of see the new front office structure, obviously. So president of baseball operations, Eric Neander, so at the very top. Then senior VP / GM, which was Neander's previous position title. So it's a very important job, clearly, is Peter Bendix, who makes me feel incredibly unaccomplished for someone of both my age and a writer for SB Nation. So for those of you that don't know, Peter Bendix, longtime friend of the site, by the way, you can look back, you can find articles as well as comments from Peter Bendix, because he was a writer at Beyond the Box Score, another fantastic SB Nation site, very analytically driven. So you can read articles from a very young, very younger.
He's still incredibly young.
But yeah, Pete Bendix, good job. You've risen higher up. So far the Rays have now two SB Nation alums in their front office with Pete Bendix and Jeff Sullivan, formerly the editor-chief of Lookout Landing. So they're just slowly, Brett, your time is coming soon. They're just going to be slowly plucking everybody. So Pete Bendix, senior VP, GM, and then VP of baseball ops are now Chanda Laudermilk and Carlos Rodriguez. So a promotion again for them. And then VP of baseball development, Will Cousins. So it looks like a nice step up for pretty much everybody involved. New titles, new responsibilities, more money, and a way of keeping really, really important pieces and keeping that consistency going forward.
And it's also good for everyone else in that front office structure, including Bendix. It's great for them. It's great that the Rays get to keep them in that front office. But when the time comes where maybe they're offered or looked at for bigger jobs where they get the keys to a franchise, to have that resume bump, I think that's really important for them. And like you said, we've seen Bloom, Click, many others. Friedman went up over to the Dodgers. It was, you know, not really a role change, but given a huge job with the Dodgers, and which he's been very successful in. Love to see that for those guys as well. It's really exciting, though, to be able to keep that front office intact. So now, Darby, I know we've been talking about him on every episode this offseason since he signed. But Brooks Raley, you just wrote a new article on DRaysBay.com about why he was worth a multi-year deal, something that we've almost never seen the Rays do with relievers. Talk to me about that article and why you think Raley is going to be such an important piece on the 2022 Rays.
Yeah, it's last time the Rays have done it was in 2014 with Grant Balfour. Neander has never given out a multi-year deal to a reliever. So when the Rays do things that they don't do normally, or they kind of go outside of the box, that always is worth like a little deeper look. You know, you kind of go, okay, what's going on there? What's happening? Raley's super interesting reliever. He, I think, already is somebody that you could trust as in the postseason. Rafael Devers is coming up. You're going to get him out because I looked into it. Obviously Raley against lefties, he is a lefty, has been absolute death to all left-handed bats. The top three since Raley came back over from the KBO, where he spent 6 years, he came over and the top three pitchers in all of baseball versus left-handed batters. Number one is Aaron Bummer, very talented lefty from the Chicago White Sox bullpen. Tied for second is Colin McHugh, who we Rays fans know all too well is a very, very strong, effective pitcher, and Brooks Raley right there in terms of top FIP against for left-handed batters. Just lefties struggle so, so mightily against Raley. He's got tons of spin. He's got tons of movement. He was a starter in Korea, so he has some length. He has six different pitches. So there's a lot of really interesting things there. But when you look at him, the things that I really found super fascinating was that he is a tinkerer. And if you listen to the This Week in Rays Baseball, where the interview that Neil Solans did with him, you can just tell that he really is a kind of student of the game type of guy. Like, he likes to tinker. He likes baseball theory. He likes pitching theory. And he chose the Rays, or was very excited the Rays chose him, but he really was excited that the Rays were interested in him because of the way the Rays have developed pitching, the way the Rays utilize their pitching, and because they have Kyle Snyder. And those are really exciting things, is that you have a pitcher who's not just, doesn't have just natural wonder ability and doesn't really, you know, needs to be like molded. He's a guy that I think can just be like with Kyle Snyder and just sort of kind of learn together. And that's what he was with Houston. You know, I had a quote from a Chandler Rome piece from the Houston Chronicle where he basically, Astros got him and we're basically like, how you can spin the ball a lot. How much more can you go? You know, how much more can you get that spin? And we just want to just push that to the envelope, just max spin all the time, everywhere. And so going to the Rays, he has this spin ability. I showed that it didn't drop after the sticky substance ban. That was also always important with anybody that can spin, especially coming from Houston. But there was no real change in RPM. So he just can spin like crazy, top 1% in baseball, both fastball and breaking ball. He can spin it like crazy. Now going with the Rays and Snyder, they can really try to work on figuring out which of his other six pitches, what kind of sequencing, location on the rubber, all these type of little tinkering things that they can do to try to get him effective against righties. Because if he can be effective against righties and he can actually get them out, not as much as lefties, but like just do okay against them. He has the length to be able to be a multi-inning guy. He has the pitching ability to potentially be a high, high leverage guy. I mean, RJ Anderson was on the pod. He raved about him. people in the know in baseball absolutely love Brix Raley. He's definitely one of those guys where you just say ERA, toss that out, doesn't matter. He is somebody that could be a top elite reliever and could absolutely be a guy like an Andrew Kittredge who kind of you're like, oh, he's good, he's there. Mm-hmm. And then 1 year, bam, he is an all-star, huge guy. So what the Rays have with Raley and why he's worth 2 years is he's already really good. He can already be the top lefty in the bullpen. He's already the guy that you can use to attack Rafael Devers. He's already the guy you can use to get Kyle Schwarber out. He's already the guy that can get if the Yankees ever decide to get some left-handed bats to take advantage of the short porch, use him to eliminate them. But there's even more. So if he can get the righties out, suddenly he ascends beyond that. But already, I think you have a very good relief pitcher who has the potential to be very, very great.
Yeah, like you said, they're not going to sign a guy to a multi-year $10 million guaranteed contract to be a lefty specialist. Like that's just not how any team should operate. Maybe the Rockies would do it. But the Rays aren't going to do that. And Cole Mitchum, when he was on, talked about how Raley, when he started to use his cutter a little bit more against righties, it was a really effective pitch for him. I have a feeling the Rays are going to look at that and say, listen, that cutter works. Let's start throwing it, because while there are a lot of teams in the AL East, like, well, specifically the Red Sox, with some dangerous left-handed bats, he's going to have to get righties out too. Because you look at that Blue Jays lineup, you look at that Yankees lineup, like, there's a lot of big-time right-handed bats, and he's going to be expected to get them out in high-leverage situations. And I have no doubt that he will be able to do that.
One last little thing on that is I also think it's a reaction to what the Rays went through last year. One of their biggest weaknesses down the stretch was all of their left-handed pitching died. You know, you saw Jeffrey Springs have a kind of a fluke ACL injury. You saw Poche, Beeks, you know, all of these lefties that they really relied on to get big outs were not available. They weren't there. And so it really put a strain on that bullpen, and it really hurt when you faced against a team like the Red Sox that had some really tough lefty bats. So getting a guy that can do that really well, that even with you with having Springs and Poche and Beeks all coming back into the fold, you still want that locked in. You are now kind of fixing a big hole that you had at the end of last year and into the postseason. So that's I think kind of reaction to, if you are looking at the end of the year and saying what went wrong, why didn't the Rays win the World Series? It's not the one reason, but it is a big part of it, was they didn't have any weapons, any left-handed weapons in the bullpen when it came time to that postseason, and that hurt. And they're not going to have that same mistake this year.
Yeah, definitely. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and on the other side, I'll do some Hall of Fame talk as we get closer to the announcement of the 2022 Hall of Fame class. And we're back on Raise Your Voice, and not a lot of signings to talk about, but the Hall of Fame, the announcement of the 2022 Hall of Fame class is a little over a month away, and there are some interesting names, obviously some names that have been discussed and debated over for the last 10 years, and we'll see if any of them get in this year. And Darby, let's jump right into it. The three closest players to the Hall of Fame, 75% you need. I think there's like 530 odd voters. Curt Schilling, 71.1%. He's in his final year. Barry Bonds, 61.8%. He's in his final year. And Roger Clemens, 61.6%. He is also in his final year. I ask you, Darby Robinson, do any of these players get inducted to the Hall of Fame this year?
I feel like there's got to be one, but I don't think so. I will tell you this. I despise Hall of Fame voting discourse, maybe more than any other baseball discourse. It's very messy. It's like a Bravo reality show, because I do also kind of like it. I like to be on the side, gawking at the absolute horrible car crash that is Hall of Fame voting discourse. And I just hope that Tom Verducci does another really insufferable video this year explaining his choice in the most pretentious possible way. I don't think any. So Schilling is really close. So he doesn't need much more to get in, but that 75% is a really high bar. And I just don't know how many people have really changed their minds. And boy, it's really, I think we might get shut out, and they might just keep it as a nice positive because the baseball committee's votes and those nominations are really, you know, pretty positive. So maybe they'll just keep it at that and not want to sully, you know, having Gil Hodges and Jim Cott and Minnie Minoso and, you know, like them going in with pretty controversial figures like Schilling and Bonds and Clemens. But yeah, here's the thing. Here's my own take. They all should be in. I think Schilling has the hardest case of those three because there is a off the field sort of part of that. But I think even still, they should probably be in. He also did say last year to not vote for him. So if people don't vote for him, they're just.
He has to be left off the ballot. And I think
following
the Hall of Fame said no. Like they were like, you have to be on the ballot.
And yeah, so it's weird. This is the worst. Like this is probably the worst year yet.
Yeah.
Like, these last 10 years have been really rough. And it's just going to be, I do feel like after this, it gets a little bit better in we don't get the moralizing is, I think, the worst part about this, right? Because it's not a matter, we're not talking about whether these people should be in the Hall of Fame based on what they did on the field. It is entirely their transgressions, both on and off the field. Are they okay enough to offset the performances on it?
Yeah.
And that is the most, it's such an annoying conversation because it really is, it's unclear. And the steroid era in general is just it's just tough because I feel like you have a lot of moralizing that has sort of it changed the rules, right? At the time, obviously steroids were against the rules, but nobody cared. People were looking the other way.
Major League Baseball didn't care, but C-League didn't care until all of a sudden, boom, they decided to care.
They cared. Yeah. And we've seen other people get in with some really rough off the field pasts, racism, sexism,
both
rampant criminality, all three at once. We have seen drug use, performance enhancing drugs that weren't anabolic steroids, but you know, all sorts of type of amphetamines usage.
Yeah.
So it's like this, we are now saying that this is a moral hall that is above that, while also saying, but ignoring the fact that there are people in there. So I'm so tired, but like Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens are two of the most iconic and talented and successful baseball players of all time.
One of them is the most successful baseball player of all time.
So like, put him in the hall. If you want to slap an asterisk on their gold plates, fine. But they are beyond reproach on the field stuff. There's no even slight question about Barry Bonds as a Hall of Famer. Whether you could even discount, you could take 50% off all of those San Francisco years. You could just take all of the San Francisco years off. He's still a Hall of Famer for everything he did in Pittsburgh. I cannot stress enough how much I hate this moralizing dilemma and discussion to the point where you can have a ballot where you have Omar Vizquel as your like sole entry and not put on Barry Bonds. Omar Vizquel, who I don't think has a case for the Hall of Fame in general. He could have been like a Roberto Clemente level good guy off the field. It doesn't matter. He's not a Hall of Famer. It's exhausting. And what's really worse is that the Schilling Bonds Clemens debate hasn't shifted into, okay, we're not going to go for them, but let me see like a guy like a Scott Rolen who played during that era, had no steroid suspicions, played amazing defense, had a very strong case offensively. There's no like push to support that or Todd Helton or even like a Andrew Jones or Gary Sheffield. Like there's this sense of like, I don't know. Like I if I'm looking at the ballot, looking at all these people on here and saying nobody gets in to the Hall of Fame on this ballot, it's that's just baffling to me. And I think that's where we're going, but there is Hall of Famers on here that belong in the Hall of Fame.
I mean, Alex Rodriguez, I think like is up there, probably top five baseball player of all time, maybe. You look at him and his and Barry Bonds' numbers, they're just absolutely incredible. And you mentioned Scott Rowland. I think I've been kind of persuaded into the Scott vote yes for Scott Rowland camp because I do think there is that argument. Like, we have no idea if he never used steroids in his career, but you could see him being up there with these players if there were no steroids being used in that time. I'm okay with the argument for him. And I think I don't get like terribly mad at people who decide that Barry Bonds should not be a Hall of Famer. But like you said, when there's this hypocrisy where you're voting for guys like Vizquel, who didn't necessarily cheat the game, but has done terrible things in baseball. Like it's been reported, like in the game of baseball, anybody voting for him and then not voting for Clemens or Bonds is very weird. I still like the voting format. I disagree with a lot of the voters on an individual level. I'm okay with writers being the voters. Maybe there should, and there is the Veterans Committee, but maybe in the regular committee, there should be some sort of player input or people that were involved in the game input. Maybe it's like a rolling committee that also gets a say. How much say? I don't know. But I'm okay with the format because you've got all these writers, over 500, and 75% of them or more have to believe that you are a Hall of Famer. And I think that's a pretty good way to determine how great a player was. I am just so excited, and I don't know when that day will come, for this steroid talk to just be gone. Because like you said, it's made it such a toxic like area of baseball discussion. And it's happened in the last 10 years now through the offseason, especially with Clemens and Bonds. And it's not going away anytime soon. You've got A-Rod and Ortiz, David Ortiz, their first years on the ballot. You've got some other guys. We mentioned before we started recording Robinson Cano, if he'll be in that Hall of Fame discussion, has been suspended for PEDs multiple times. I don't think we'll get there, but there's also going to be like the sticky stuff guys. I don't think that'll ever be a Hall of Fame thing, but
I
maybe
can't
it will.
Wait to Who hear knows? Years from now with old like.
Well, Jose Altuve, like, Carlos Correa, Michael Brantley. I don't know if Brantley's a Hall of Famer, but there's going to be more of this.
It's coming, yeah. Bregman, potentially, yeah. Like his career continues. Oh, yeah, no, it's, oh, boy, yeah. It's rough. It's rough. It's not
okay,
great.
And I am okay if when the time comes, if a voter decides, you know, Carlos Correa, I think he cheated. They were caught cheating. He never owned up to it. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer. Fine. But this these toxic conversations where two people just are so stuck in like I'm okay if Barry Bonds if someone decides not to vote for Barry Bonds. I think I would. But if someone doesn't, that's fine. I am tired of the discourse though. So I guess that's why it's a great idea we just talk about it here on the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. this is because of the lockout. We have to dedicate time
this would
to
not
this.
Be part of the podcast if we actually had a real offseason ongoing.
I think that's my thing. I don't think it's necessarily the wrong way of going about voting. It's just the even if you have your take, which is for some reason, I mean, there was a voter, I can't remember who it was. I'm not going to look it up or care to look it up ever. But like they voted for Barry Bonds, but not for Roger Clemens. I have no idea what possible like mental like gymnastics you got to get there. But also, sure, whatever, that's your choice. I am with you in the sense where it's like, here's my op-ed as to why I'm not voting for Barry Bonds. And it's like, I don't care. I really don't care. I would like to know your reasoning because I love to know like the reasoning. And then I can go, wow. Where'd you come up with that? Wow, fascinating. And then just move on. And then to be like, okay, whatever. Because I think you just say like, listen, I'm not going to vote for any of the steroid guys. Okay, fine. I think you're wildly overlooking people that maybe did that just didn't get caught or didn't get fully caught, but they seem to have a weird spike. It's just a weird discourse. And you know, you're probably going to see a couple more years with Manny Ramirez. There's some, you know, there's that. You're looking at, yeah, A-Rod's on his first year of ballot and David Ortiz on his first year of ballot. Those are both Hall of Fame players.
I'm very curious what their numbers look like year one, because we've seen some of like the Bonds and Clemens numbers fluctuate year to year, which I've also found really weird. I know there's a, you can only vote for 10, but it's like which voters are changing their minds on guys from year to year. I don't get
especially
that.
Especially at that level. Like at like a Bond, like I can see where you have like an Andrew Jones maybe who you're like on the fringe about.
Maybe you've learned some more.
But yeah. But like it is hard to be like Barry Bonds. You either are for him and you're not minding the steroids, or you're taking that out and you're just using the Pittsburgh years or whatever, or you are not voting for him ever.
Right.
Like I don't think you could vote for him and then be like, actually, never mind. Now that Mark Burley's on the list, I can't fit him in there. He was on my bubble, but I gotta make sure that Andy Pettit gets a vote. Like
I hate the term first ballot Hall of Famer. That just sounds like Hall of Famers. Like these guys have been retired for 5 years. You've had a lot of time to think about if you believe they're a Hall of Famer or not.
Well,
that's the other weird thing. There is no like set bar for Hall of Fame. It's literally
sliding scale. Everybody's just chasing.
We can say he's got more WAR than 50% of the Hall of Famers at his position. But someone's going to always have to be the lowest WAR Hall of Famer at their position. That doesn't make them any less of a Hall of Famer. And so who's to say that someone with less WAR than that person can't be inducted? Like, it's such a weird, weird thing, which does make for some fun discussion, but also some very frustrating discussion as well.
My favorite discussion is getting the moralizing out and just talking about, like, the peaks versus sustained, you know, type of discussion, right? I'm very much more for like, if you had a peak where you had maybe 4 years where you were one of the three best players at your position or best in the game, and then you had a, you know, you maybe only had like an 11, 12 year career, and some of those years were lost to injury, but you had a period where you were the best at your sport or right up there, and then a couple of years where you were in the top 20, and then you kind of burned out. That could maybe make a really interesting case. I'm more that. I respect the people that are like 20-year good, not great ever career, where you're just like, you were consistently putting out a good product. You were never a negative player, but you were never like the best. That can be also worthy. So I like that debate where it's like, this person's peak is better than that person's peak, but this person had more years at success, you know? So those are more interesting to me because I think you can make a case like in terms of just personal preference, right? The moralizing parts, it's just, I can't stand that.
We're going to talk about one more player. The only player that if you were to be inducted would go in as a Devil Ray and a couple of years as a Ray as well, that has had some off the field issues. I don't think in his case, if he had a case for the Hall of Fame, would impact him that much, but maybe. I don't think these things have been really in the public eye that much, at least not on a national level. But of course, we're talking about Carl Crawford in his first year on the ballot. I'm very interested to see, because I think he might stay on the ballot. It wouldn't shock me if he barely eclipses 5%. He's not going to be inducted, though.
No, and he never will, because I don't think he has the longevity either. He has memorabilia in the Hall of Fame. His single game steals cleats are there. He has an interesting peak, you know, but he was never really at the top of it. Altogether, 41.5 career F WAR, which is right on the cusp of a lot of Hall of Famers. Like that's lower end for sure, but not
for a left fielder too. I think that's impressive. You know, he's not playing center.
Yeah, it's not a bad resume. It's not a Hall of Fame resume. It's an interesting case. And he had, you know, he has a 7-win season. That's great. He has a couple of 5-win season, 1-6-win season, bunch of 4-win, 3-win seasons. So sustained with a couple of peaks. What always strikes me though, as a way of, I think that really hurts players especially, is he had a potential Hall of Fame like building career at 28, gets his big contract to go to Boston. He then does not have like another great year. And so that's the big flaw, is going from age 29 to 34, he has two good, not great kind of seasons where he's a two-win player with the Dodgers, kind of has a little bit of a bounce back, then two, you know, he's more of a reserve guy, not like a starter, more in platoon role. I think he goes from having a six-win season, a seven-win season, big contract in a big market, to then flatlining. And that basically ends his chances because he doesn't add any really parts to his Hall of Fame legacy after the age of 28. Mm-hmm. And that's when most people, that's when their prime start. Yeah. And that's when the Hall of Fame resume is built, is that like 5-year period between 28 and 33. And if had he continued on at a 3-4-5 win pace in that period, you add suddenly another 20, 25, you're looking at 60 WAR. That's a pretty good resume for a left fielder, especially if he's doing it in Boston, especially if there's a World Series in there, you get a little bit more of that attention. Or if he went to LA and like recaptured something and like kind of put together like another peak year there, you know, at one of those big market places, gets a few more, you get a few more eyes and more writers on you to potentially help vote. That's a big part of it, is these guys that stayed with one club, especially if it's a smaller market club, like your Todd Helton's, suddenly, are they really getting the support that they should?
They do stand out more too. Like a Todd Helton, you're like, you think Todd Helton, you think the Rockies in that era, mm-hmm. you think Todd Helton. If there are voters that think about the Devil Rays, you think in Carl Crawford. And I think mm-hmm. that's why he could stay on. Those voters that go, Carl Crawford, man, he was incredible for a long period of time for the Devil Rays. Had over 400 stolen bases when he was with the mm-hmm. team. Was one of the best outfielders in baseball. I think he won All-Star Game MVP one year when he hit a home run. Did he hit a home run in the All-Star Game? Or am I thinking of someone else?
I don't remember.
Not that that's going to influence any voters, but maybe they remember that moment and they remember who Carl Crawford was when he was with the Devil Rays and on that first Rays team that went to the postseason, went to the World Series. Mm-hmm. Again, he's never going to get anywhere near 75%, but I am curious to see if he gets the 5% to stick on. And I think he will. I'm willing to bet that he does. He might get like 8%. Who knows? There's a lot of voters. So that'll be an interesting one. And again, I'll mention there's been some off the field stuff. I don't know if any of those stories have been in that national eye enough, at least on the baseball side of things. Like there's in the music industry, he's been like his name has been a hot topic for a couple of years now. But I don't think I don't think Tom Verducci has caught up on the Megan Thee Stallion controversy.
Oh boy, I sure want to hear his take on it, though.
That's what the video is going to be about this year.
That's going to be him listening to WAP and him sitting down with his pen, the music video on in the background.
You're gonna see him hover over Carl Crawford on the ballot and be like, "Sorry, can't do it."
No, like, can't do it.
oh no.
Yeah, you have to Google what like bougie means. No, he would know. He would know that because of just he would know that because of Russian like literature.
Yes, yes.
He wouldn't be like, I don't know what the kids are saying, but he must be talking about Marx. I don't think I would like to see him stick on the ballot. But yeah, I mean, I think it depends on if people like stolen bases like that. That's like he's a throwback to that. I think there was an era where stolen bases were a big part of baseball, and he is on this ballot as like one of the big stolen base, you know, kind of guys. There's some other interesting triples guys,
which is like just a ton of fun, most exciting play. Well, some would argue the most exciting play in baseball. Like, I mean, 19 triples, 15 triples, 16 triples. His last year did 13 triples with the Rays. Like, mm-hmm. man,
very, even if he had interesting
three more like prime seasons, and that's a lot to ask. Like maybe he goes to Boston and is a stud for one of those teams, sticks around when they win the World Series. Like he could have a much better case.
It would have been right there on the fringe, and kind of using that kind of as a looking at the ballot this year and kind of looking at Rays potentially in the future, you know, as we hunt to see that first Ray in the Hall of Fame besides Wade Boggs. I look at Andrew Jones, and I'm seeing 33.9% so far of the total vote in, fifth year on the ballot, just not really gaining a lot of traction. That's your, like, okay, if Carl Crawford ever had a chance,
yeah.
If Andrew Jones isn't there, there's no chance for Crawford, or for Crawford or for KK. I think those are where you're like, okay, defensive power, speed, coming up youth, like very young, 20. Mm-hmm. Andrew Jones does belong in the Hall of Fame for me. I agree. He's not getting the traction. So you're like, okay, that's probably not there. And then Scott Rolen. I think that is your test case. Five more years on the ballot. He's at 50 percentile right now. Hopefully he ends somewhere in that 60 range. So that's looking good to potentially get over the hump eventually. But if Rolen never gets in, Longoria is never getting in.
Right.
I think that's your very much your line of, if you were not going to go for a guy who had, you know, defense first, best defense at your position for a number of years, a couple of really good peak years, some offense, like isn't a slouch on offense. Longoria maybe a little bit more offense, Rolen a little bit more on the defense. But if Rolen can't get in, Longoria is not getting in. So those are the two guys I look at as, okay, is there potential there? And
yeah, for Longoria, we talk about inexplicable late career resurgences with some of these guys that may or may not have used performance enhancing drugs. I think Evan Longoria would need some steroid seasons for him to have a chance at the Hall of Fame. Like, he's got to stay healthy for one, and you need to put up some just crazy offensive seasons that make you, when you look at his Baseball Reference, go, huh, how did that happen? Before we raise our voices, because we're going to talk about a player that's currently on the raise that there might someday be a Hall of Fame case for, I do want to ask you, because I kind of threw around this idea before last season started, and that's an important caveat. Before last season started, if you were to sit down and do a two-person, say it's me and you, doing a Rays Hall of Fame draft, where you're trying to draft as many Hall of Famers from the Rays organization as possible, knowing very well there's a good chance both people end up with zero, but your goal is to try to get the most Hall of Famers. At the beginning of last year, I think that's a very interesting debate to have. Mm-hmm. Now this year, I think there's a pretty clear number one overall pick after even just 70 games in the big leagues. So I want to ask you, if you had the first pick in a draft, me and you, say Wander Franco's off the board, because I think that would be your answer. Would it be your answer?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay,
who are you drafting if you in a Hall of Fame draft to try to get a Hall of Fame? Anyone from the current organization, doesn't have to be in the big leagues yet.
It's really tricky, because I kind of want to go pitching. But I worry when I look at the Hall of Fame ballots that the pitching bar is too high for any modern pitcher to ever reach.
Things would have to change a lot, which there would. Yeah. Like, if you pick a young enough guy, the game could change a lot.
Which is where I'm kind of, that's where I'd be kind of hopeful there. I would say, I'm not going to go with Zunino. I'm going to have to go with Shane Baz.
Okay.
It's a real tough one, because pitching is it's very fragile, obviously, but he has, in terms of the most explosive, most exciting stuff of anybody in this organization, outside of maybe a healthy Tyler Glass now.
Yeah.
There is the potential for a really high peak. Right. And with the Rays, you have a team that will build to the pitcher's strength. We saw with Tyler Glasnow, they let him go longer because he can go longer. With Snell, they were able to kind of get the best out of him by shielding him a little bit from his mistakes of third time through the order penalty. So I think you could see some really big seasons from a Shane Baz if he develops the way that a lot of people kind of think he could, and kind of reach into that level. Now, maybe not the longevity, but if you had a peak of like maybe 3 to 5 years of 6-7 win stuff, you get a Cy Young in there, and then just sort of stick around, or maybe you throw it, go into the bullpen, become an elite closer like a John Smoltz. There's a potential for, and the culture for pitching and the ideas of what that does change. That's a big, big point. That's a good point, Brett. I think Shane Baz would be my pick if Wander is off the board.
Yeah, I think that's a good number one pick. Again, like there's so many guys that are already on the big league roster. It's like they probably don't have a case anymore. Like Tyler Glass now, who's going to be like 29 when he pitches again, mm-hmm. and hasn't pitched a full season in the big leagues yet. Like there's just not going to be enough time for him unless they put in when he, you know, got Tommy John some sort of bionic UCL and he can last another 12 seasons. Like there's just not going to be the time. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know if there's enough to do a podcast there, but maybe there would be. Again, once you get after like the first two rounds of picks, like you just pick, you know, throwing lottery picks out there. Like I might just go all prospects. I might not take anybody on the active roster after Shane Boz. You might just, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. I think the other really interesting one to pick in this, if I had to go with a position player, is Randy Arozarena, because you know, he is 26, so he's a little older now for that.
Coming off of his rookie season.
Coming off of that rookie year. But he already has, you know, rookie of the year. So he's got an award.
ALCS MVP.
He has the ALCS MVP. He has postseason records. Yeah. He has some stuff where he became the player that everybody knew and could name for a postseason. That's big. Like the Rays lost the World Series in 2020, but he was the player that people remember. Like that is the guy from that postseason that people were like, everybody's like, oh yeah, Randy Arozarena. So he would have to have a long way to go. You know, 3-win season in his rookie year is great. He would need to have a couple of, like, I'd say probably 6+ win seasons and maybe extend into his later 30s. But with that postseason, if he became a consistent, like hot in the postseason guy,
right?
You have seen guys with a less than stellar resume, or maybe not less than stellar, but like a lesser resume that gets really boosted. I think you look at a Jack Morris type, right? He was around forever, didn't really have a peak, but he had postseason memorable moments, and that's what kind of propelled his case forward. So I think with Randy, maybe you just have a guy that's a very good major leaguer in the regular season, 3-4-5 win player, if it can stretch out enough, and then have like some amazing October moments. There's, you know, right. It's all based on the writers. And you mentioned that the writers' cases, the reasons for certain guys, it's entirely nebulous. So if you're just like, wow, that guy, Mr. October. Okay. Maybe that's the guy, like maybe that's a case there, is that he always performed in the clutch. He kind of get like a little bit of the Derek Jeter juice going, where it's like this guy is always performing in the clutch. It's a real long shot, honestly. Like looking at the thing, it's like it's tough. It's like I want to pick the real answer is I want to take the Rays 2024 international free agent. Yeah. Like the top international free agent, the Rays pick in 2025 or 2026.
Well, I wouldn't be far off from drafting Carlos Colmenares. And like, we have known nothing about him, but he was their free agent signing. Like, he's got a better shot than Austin Meadows, probably. Like, because we just don't know what he's capable of yet. Yeah. So I'd probably go like Arozarena, Lau, McClanahan.
Mm-hmm. Second baseman, there is a little bit of a tougher, like there's plenty of room there to be maybe one of the best second basemen of the generation.
Yeah.
Hit out, you know, most home runs. We're seeing Jeff Kent struggle, which is big problem for a Laub, because he was one of the better like defensive or offensive second baseman of his era.
Or like a Dan Uggla.
Yeah.
But you again, need to see Laub do another like 8 seasons of this. And that's impossible. But again, a very probably pointless but fun draft to have of like who's going to make the Hall of Fame. Maybe you did it if we were actually to score it out. Who do you think will get the most Hall of Fame percentage votes? You know, maybe that would be a better way. Who's going to be on the ballot? Who's going to rack up the most percentage of votes for their time on the ballot? Maybe that would be a fun way to do it, because I could see a Randy Arozarena or a Brandon Lau getting on the ballot if they have a few more years like this. You know, that's not
again with Randy. It's like you have already moments that are Hall of Fame worthy.
Stealing so home in the playoffs, like
if you can get 10 years of that, which is a huge if, but if you get 10 years of that,
yeah,
I don't know, that matters. Like you could be like, well, this guy wasn't, I mean, like Omar Vizquel is getting, again, not to hammer Omar Vizquel, but he's getting there because he was around baseball for a long time. That's it.
Yeah,
like he was never even had a peak. Like he was just on a baseball roster for 20 years. So there is some case that you can make a case out of nothing. So like if Randy has maybe a 7-year good career and it's like 10 years total, and those last 3 years are completely bad, but in those 7 years, he has like, he steals home again. He has another like 10 home run.
Rays win the World Series.
He gets like a World Series moment. He wins World Series MVP. Like if you get some of that in there, suddenly you may not have the best like on the field case, but you could potentially be the guy that are like, oh wow, every writer, because everybody pays attention in October, every writer has a memory of a Hall of Fame je ne sais quoi.
Mm-hmm. There's one name we didn't mention in that, and there's the guy that we might be making a case to be in the Hall of Fame coming up right after this break. And we're back on Raise Your Voice. Just went through a lengthy Hall of Fame discussion, which turned into a mini Rays Hall of Fame draft. We mentioned how Shane Baz, we took Wander Franco off the table. Shane Baz, Brandon Lau, Randy Rosarena were our top picks if we were to have this draft. There's one name, though, and it's someone we might be trying to make the case. It's been the discussion on Rays Twitter. There was an article on D-Rays Bay. People were poo-pooing it on Rays Reddit, saying, I can't believe they're writing this sort of thing on D-Rays Bay. Why are they giving this the time of day? And that is the case for Kevin Kiermaier, Darby's best friend, to be a baseball Hall of Famer.
So
just that sound.
All right. So JT Morgan had a really good article about this, where he kind of takes the idea of like, let me try to argue this out. And in typical JT fashion, by the end of it, he is thoroughly convinced himself against it, because he's just like, can't even like make the case. It would need, I think there was a Hall of Fame career on the precipice. I was looking at this today. I was looking at his stats. I don't think he has a Hall of Fame case. I don't see any potential of getting there. Like I mentioned, if Andrew Jones is struggling to get votes, Kevin Kiermaier has no shot. But I do think there was a point where he had a Hall of Fame trajectory, and it just didn't quite get that way. And that's okay. You know, he's 31.
He's very good. He's in a very, very good.
He's very good. Yeah. And he's going to have, he had, like we mentioned with Randy, he had Hall of Fame moments, mm-hmm. right? He have moments, you have memories of like, wow, that was one of the best plays of that year. And he won a platinum glove. I think the point where it all kind of goes downhill again, and it's right in the same place where Carl Crawford kind of like dropped off, which is right in that 27, 28, 29 year. So 2017, Kevin Kiermaier, he gets hurt for most of the year, or at least a big chunk of the year. He only plays 98 games, coming off a year where he only played 105 games. Both of those years, though, he comes off a 4-win season and a 3-win season. He has over 100 WRC plus. The defense is incredible. He just doesn't have enough games, but like those are your potential peak years. And that's coming off of 2 4-win seasons. So in a row, you have like 3 wins, 4 wins, 4 wins, 3 wins, all in a row with a lot of injuries in there to potentially make it potentially 6-7-win season with that offense. After that, though, he doesn't break 2 wins until this past year. And that's a combination of his bat just completely eroding. You know, it didn't need to be much offense. It only needed to be right at that 95 to 105 WRC plus range.
Right around
average.
Just
needed to be just right around average bat. You know, he had enough pop, not too much, 10, 15 home runs, just enough base hits, get some triples in there, get some steals in there, and let the defense and let the glove kind of make the case. But then more injuries, more, you know, kind of some short season effects. Just the bat really fell off the plate there for him. I think had he consistently stayed healthy and put together 4 to 5 wins each and every year to this point, suddenly you're looking at a guy that's in the 35-40 career WAR range. So that's right on the fringe. And then you could see another 5 years if he stayed healthy. Big ifs, but stayed healthy. The speed and the glove doesn't, you know, take that step back, which is what JT said, is for a guy that's built so much around speed, you really do think like if you lose a step or two, that greatly reduces his abilities on the field, but stays healthy, is able to keep playing center field at a high level, maybe not platinum glove, but like consistently getting in that gold glove caliber race. There was a Hall of Fame trajectory. The last few years kind of ended that trajectory. So he's going to be a guy I don't think gets, maybe he gets a vote or two in you know, a decade plus when he's on the ballot. But he's a one and done on the ballot type of guy. But I could see the trajectory there. I could see where that was going. It just, sadly, which happens to a lot of players, it just never developed because of that. Hall of very good, though. Hall of very good, I think, is where it's going to all end up, which is, I think, there's a lot of very fun players in that Hall of very good that doesn't exist. Should be built in Ithaca or something. You know, not Cooperstown, but maybe outside of Cornell.
And I think, almost without a doubt, if there's ever – I don't know if the Rays would retire his number. I think right now, like, Longoria is the only player whose number isn't retired that will be. If there's ever some sort of Ring of Honor or Team Hall of Fame, other way to honor players if inside the stadium in some way, I think without a doubt Kevin Kiermaier in that right away. Like right up there with David Price, Evan Longoria, Ben Zobrist, James Shields, Scott Kazmir, BJ Upton, I would put him in there. That group of players, like all-time Rays players, maybe even Chris Archer, without a doubt for me, he goes right in there. If they ever decided, which I think they should do something like that. I'm all for honoring like your franchise greats. And it doesn't have to, I'm not a big fan of retiring numbers. So I'd love to see some sort of team Hall of Fame.
Get that statue with the Ybor
Stadium. Oh, he'd be a great statue. If you could actually.
The Ybor Stadium.
The thing is that you can't mess it up though. We've seen some really botched statues. Like if you're going to do a Kevin Kiermaier statue, it's got to look like Kevin Kiermaier, and there's got to be some sort of way to get the eyes on the statue. Cuz if they're just bronze like some eyes,
LEDs. Yeah, LEDs. Yeah.
You're not getting the essence of Kevin Kiermaier. You've got to get like the 5 o'clock shadow down. It's going to have to be a really nice statue to pull off that look. Ben Whitelaw of RBLR Sports. He's the one that started this discussion on Twitter. Again, everybody knows that I've been Kevin Kiermaier's biggest supporter, but maybe not. Maybe it's been Ben. His Twitter, at dogpancake73. I don't know. You have to ask him about that. he put out a couple threads about why Kevin Kiermaier could be a Hall of Famer. And again, I'm not going to try to sit here and tell you guys that today he has a Hall of Fame resume. I will say, and it would take something monumental, either a monumental shift in how defense is perceived, because like we said, he's been, his career OPS plus is 98. I'm sure his WRC plus is there or thereabouts. If there is this extreme change perception of defense and the role it plays in baseball, then Kevin Kiermaier's name would have to be in the discussion. Or also, if there's some way to retroactively reevaluate defense, a metric or some set of numbers that we don't currently have access to, but maybe they can go back and look with the StatCast data that currently exists to show from what I see on the field and what I truly believe that he has been the best defensive outfielder in the game for almost his entire career. And if there is some better way to quantify that shows that his glove is just as valuable as some of the game's best bats are or best arms are, then maybe there's a case for Kevin Kiermaier. I don't think that's likely. His current numbers aren't there, but I do think there's a heavy bias on players whose bat gets them there. Mm-hmm. So much so where you ignore some really horrendous defense from some of these players that can't be buried or were not buried in a designated hitter role or moved to a position that's not shortstop. Like, I'm even looking at you, Derek Jeter. I'm not here to say that Derek Jeter's not a Hall of Famer. I hate that. Like, he is 100%, 1,000% a Hall of Famer. But to say that he is this great defensive shortstop that earned countless gold gloves, that's just asinine, but Kevin Kiermaier is. He has been that. He deserves, even now into his 30s, to be the center fielder when the Rays have two elite center fielders right behind him in Brett Phillips and Manuel Margot. I still believe he's the best of that bunch into his 30s. These are guys that are younger. These are guys that, as of right now, make less than him. So the Rays have decided to keep Kevin Kiermaier. That shows a lot about his defensive abilities. I think I am here for all the Kevin Kiermaier support. Maybe I'll get Ben on the podcast at some point this offseason. I know I'm supposed to go on RBLR with them. So I'm here in the middle of the lockout with no signings going on, no trades going on, to just talk about Kevin Kiermaier and how great he's been in a Rays uniform.
I love the passion. I love the passion.
Yes.
It's a long offseason, made longer with the lockout too. So I actually like this debate. And in all honesty, one of the things we joke a lot about, I have not been the biggest Kevin Kiermaier supporter. But there is a level of respect that you have to have for Kevin Kiermaier as a player. He is the best defensive center fielder of his generation, right? Yeah. Like there was always a guy that you could be like, ooh, it's him versus Kevin Pillar. It's him versus Brian Buxton. And still, it's just, well, Kevin Kiermaier, he's at the top, right?
Is there a place in the Hall of Fame for a player like that?
See, the way the Hall is built, no. But I want to see Kevin Kiermaier's like glove, his platinum glove there, which I believe it is. I think the Hall, for me, I've been to the Hall of Fame a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And by far the most interesting part of the Hall of Fame is not the plaques in that section. It is the museum that is there.
That hall cool is, it's kind of small, you know, you see some old guys' faces and then that's it. But yeah.
It's like, okay, this is cool. Like, this is great. Like, oh, there's the plaque for, you know, some like legendary players. Some legendary players, some legendary great ball players, and the other players that would have tried to keep them out of the Hall of Fame if they could. It's a great prestigious place where you can look at Frank Robinson and then look across at the guy that would have been trying to keep him from ever playing the game if he had his way. So yeah, exactly. It's doesn't have the same power to me, right? So you can see some people be like, wow, that guy is a great player. And you know, it's a great place to bring kids to, you know, maybe teach, but the by far the most interesting place where I have seen kids running around and I have acted like a kid is in the museum part, where you can see Carl Crawford's cleats and you can see these like artifacts and you can see a little blurb or a video of like what happened in that moment. And it really captures the game of baseball, which is what I believe the Hall of Fame is. And I do think Kevin Kiermaier belongs in the museum. I believe I want to see some of the highlights from Kevin Kiermaier live on, because they are some of the all-time best catches and plays that we have ever seen in baseball history. And I think that has a place, and it belongs in the museum, which is, I think, the best part of Cooperstown anyway.
I like that point a lot. And this is a lot like making the argument for like the best punter for like 12 years to go in and again, different Hall of Fames, but it's like that person was the best at what he did. Nobody was better. Doesn't he deserve a spot in the Hall of Fame? Kevin Kiermaier, like you said, is the best center fielder, defensive center fielder of his generation. He does deserve to be honored in some. And I think if someone were to argue and vote for him to be in the Hall of Fame, again, I would have no problem with that. As things stand, I would not vote for him if I were a voter. But I am all for the charge. I am very much in support of anyone who does believe that Kevin Kiermaier is a Hall of Famer. Darby, any final thoughts? You had any idea when this lockout's going to end?
I'm not even going to think about it until February, right? Like, it's clearly the players and the owners were, when the lockout started, they were not ever going to even talk until after the new year. So that like already you were like, December's gone. January, I think you're going to start to see a slow return to business, but it's going to take a couple of weeks before anything gets serious. February, that's going to be the month where they actually are like, all right, let's be real now. And then, because now suddenly there's a ticking clock. Just like Stadium Saga stuff, there's nothing is real until there's a ticking clock. And just like me in college, until there's a deadline, I am not opening my computer and typing a single word. I know it's coming. It would probably be better if I got working on it now. It would be better if the owners and the players union were working on it now. But once the deadline is coming, they're going to pound some coffee, they're going to pound some Red Bulls, and they're going to get down and they're going to type and they're going to put together an adequate B grade, probably collective bargaining unit that hopefully is a B grade or A plus for the players and a C minus for the owners because they have plenty. But I don't think anything happens until February because then it becomes real.
Yeah, I agree with you there. So that's going to do it for this week's episode of Raise Your Voice. Thank you to Darby for coming on, and thank you to everyone for listening. As always, make sure to head on over to draysbay.com to check out all of our great offseason coverage, including Darby's article on Brooks Raley and the Rays' decision to give him a multi-year deal. If you like what we do, rate and review our podcast if your platform allows it. And if you want every new episode of Raise Your Voice, of D-Raise Bay podcast specials, and of course, Who's on Worst, hosted by Darby and Ashley McLennan, make sure to subscribe or follow, whatever term your platform calls it. And that will help you guys get every new episode from the D-Raise Bay podcast network. Once again, thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you. Well, I'll probably take a quick break for the holidays, but I'll talk to you after Christmas.